Welcome to War Machine, a podcast for theological nomads. I recently spoke with Larry Jordan about his recently published book called The Way. According to Larry's website, the book integrates religion and science and reconciles Eastern and Western worldviews, confirming along with the mystics and scientists that everyone is related and everything is connected. The book recognizes the perennial philosophy that underlies many spiritual traditions. Reading The Way is like having a cup of coffee with Bart Ehrman, Eckhart Tolle, Thich Nhat Hanh, and Albert Einstein. That would be a fun coffee date. I once again have to apologize for not picking the right microphone and therefore for the quality of the audio. I've got to be better about that. But I really enjoyed the conversation and really thankful that Larry reached out and we were able to connect and talk about the journey he's been on since 9/11. I'll link to Larry's website where you can take a look at what he's up to, get in touch, get the book, etc. I have one announcement here. Our friends from the Center for Process Studies and the California Institute of Integral Studies are hosting a conference Friday, March 29th to Sunday, March 31st in San Francisco, but it's also going to be online. The name of the conference is Metaphysics and the Matter with Things, Thinking with Ian McGilchrist. If you're not sure who Ian McGilchrist is or what this conference is all about, there's a description. I'll just read it. Ian McGilchrist's recent magnum opus, The Matter with Things, 2021, constitutes one of the most significant contributions to the contemporary process tradition, as revealed through layers of neuroscientific data and decades of remarkable clinical research into brain lateralization and the hemisphere hypothesis. Drawing from multiple scientific disciplines, and from both ancient and modern philosophers, including Heraclitus, Schelling, James, Bergson, Whitehead, and others, McGilchrist has established himself as a formidable process thinker committed to reintegrating the holistic modes of thought associated with the right hemisphere as a guide to cultural renewal. As part of this effort, he affirms the ontological irreducibility of relationality, time, value, purpose, experience, consciousness, and the sacred. The conference brings together leading process thinkers across various disciplines, including physics, neuroscience, psychology, philosophy, and theology, into critical dialogue with McGilchrist's work in a collegial effort to assess, question, extend, and apply it. I don't have the list in front of me of all the speakers, but a couple that quickly come to mind, just because of my familiarity with them, John Vervaeke and Matt Siegel will be there. Matt's one of the co-organizers, along with Andrew Davis. So if that sounds like something you're interested in, the in-person tickets are sold out, but there's plenty of space left in the virtual audience. And we have an affiliate link you'll find in the show notes. If you go through there, you'll get $25 off the $75 admission. And so you'd get quite a lot, I think, for $50. So I invite you to check that out. We're at warmachinepodcast.com. Here's Larry Jordan. Peace.
Well, spent most of my life in the Northeast, you know, grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, great place to grow up. Went to school, thought I was going to be a city manager, and I ended up doing investment banking for cities and schools and state agencies. You know, when they need to borrow money, they would come find me. And so it was it was good money, but it was a lot of stress, a lot of travel, and it was sort of soul killing work, you know?
Yeah.
And I was very transactional. I was somebody that, you know, I only got paid if I closed. So I figured out how to close, and I did that as much as I could. And, you know, around my 50s and stuff, I started asking questions, all the big questions, kind of midlife stuff. You know, I was raised Catholic. I had a lot of Catholic guilt. You know, I felt like, gosh, you know, I'm healthy. I'm still married. My kids are launched. My parents are alive. I have financial security.
Things are going too well.
Too well, exactly. Yeah. And then also, I started sort of thinking about my purpose. And, you know, I was kind of inspired by the story of the rich young man in the gospel where he says, you know, sell your stuff and follow me. And I thought to myself, you know, I'm a pretty decent guy. I've been a good, as well as I could, a good dad and a good husband, good boss, good employee, you know. But, you know, if I really think about it, how many times have I reached out and helped somebody, not because I was supposed to or because I was paid to, just because I was going to do something for somebody else? I could count it on one hand. And I thought, you know, I've been alive for 20,000 days and I can count 5 days I did something nice for somebody. So I just thought I'd really need to rebalance my life. So
yeah,
around this time that, you know, the 9/11 hit, and I'm thinking, and this was political, not really religious or spiritual. I just thought, what kind of religion, you know, crashes airplanes into buildings? Didn't take me long to figure out, well, no religion does that. And I was really entranced by Islam, and particularly the Sufis, the mystics of Islam. And I sort of thought, well, why don't we have Christian mystics? Of course we do, but we just don't hear about it. So I kind of realized as I was looking at Islam that I didn't know that much about Christianity either. And I thought that I was going to sort of confirm everything they ever told me in church. And, you know, the being Catholic, you think, well, Jesus talked to the first pope and he talked to the second pope. And eventually, you know, we got what we got today. But it's all absolute, clear, unchanging, universal. And I tell people it was like I went to, you know, roast marshmallows and I accidentally burned my house down. I mean, I just didn't really know that I was going to be so unsettled. And at the same time, you know, I'm kind of reaching around trying to figure out, well, how do I make sense of all this? And I was really captivated by the Eastern religions and the mystics and the quantum physicists. And it just seemed like they were all saying, you know, you can believe what you want to believe, but the one thing we know is that we're connected. You know, there's a oneness to the universe. It's physical. It's not woo-woo stuff. It's, there really is non-locality and connection. And so while I'm on my kind of rich young man path, I'm starting to volunteer and I'm getting out of my safe space and I'm meeting people of all shapes and sizes. And I'm developing a little more empathy for, you know, people that are in bad situations are not there because of bad choices. And so I just sort of started opening up. And I also felt like, well, this has all gotten very intellectual. You know, I really need some experience. So I spent some time in a sweat lodge and chanted to Shiva and whirled with the dervishes and meditated in a zendo, all, like I say, and it's sort of in service of oneness. And so at the end of this process, it probably took 20 years. It was gut-wrenching. I mean, as I talk to you now, I'm very casual about it. I'm very comfortable with where I am. You know, I just sort of tied up as much as I can tie up. But, you know, probably as recently as 5 years ago, I was really still unsettled by the whole thing.
Yeah.
And my kids at one point said, oh, darn, what happened to you? You know, you used to be this single-minded sort of type A transactional guy. Now you're like all warm and fuzzy. You have all these friends. You have deep friendships. You laugh a lot. You cry a lot. I mean, whatever you're doing, more people should do it.
Right. And
I said, well, I couldn't tell you in a sentence. I mean, I read 1,000 books. I baked in a sweat lodge. I'd have to write a book about it. They said, well, you should do that. And I had not done that before, hadn't planned on doing that, had read 1,000 books, not taken a single note. But the book that came out of it was very conversational. It was sort of like, well, my kids asked me what I learned and where I learned it, and here it is. Very deliberate about the tone of the book, because you and I can have all kinds of conversations about consciousness and free will and self and soul, and nobody's particularly upset or challenged by that. But, you know, a lot of the people in the pews, if I were to say to somebody, you know, I just don't think I have a soul, you know, it would be upsetting to people. It is upsetting to people. And so, you know, the tone of the book, the last thing I wanted to do is say, well, here's a bunch of stuff you learn in church. It's not true. Larry Jordan's going to tell you what's true, because
right.
I'm not going to do that. And I can't do that. And a lot of what we want to figure out is unanswerable, you know. So the tone of the book is very forgiving, you know. It's like, hey, here's some good questions. Here's some ways that people think about it. You can sort of tell, how I feel about things by reading the book. It's not absolute. And people that like the book really like the book. And people in interviews say things like, well, this guy, he asks a lot of great questions. He doesn't tell you what to believe. He sort of says you're supposed to focus on the fundamentals of, hey, we're all connected and we're all related. And, you know, I tell people, it might sound trite, you know, if I tell you I read 1,000 books and that's what I came up with. But I said, you know, for me, and again, I don't want to prescribe for anybody else, but for me, if everybody's my brother, everybody's related, everything's connected. You know, I think back to 4 years ago, I'm not going to ban Muslims. I'm not going to build walls. I'm not going to separate families. I'm not going to take away people's health care. You know, I live my life a different way than I used to. So the book is a really unique book. There's a little bit of autobiography, only enough to make it personal and also to show the the important thing to me is this is not just intellectual stuff. It's transformative. You know, if you change the way you think, you change the way you live and everything changes. And part of the reason I did it, you know, I have young grandsons. I'm the guy that tickles and wrestles and tells fart jokes. And that's okay. I'm glad to be remembered that way. But, you know, someday when
I mean, that's a honorary position.
Exactly. But, you know, someday when I'm gone, somebody pulls the book off the shelf and says, oh, gosh, well, this guy, he had a few breaks of us. You know, he's not just a clown.
Right. There's a lot of things that are interesting in there. What you said matches up with one of the things that I took away from the early parts of your book, where you're setting out on this journey after 9/11. I think it's impossible to avoid this straightforward political ramifications or implications of an event like that. And you kind of gave us a brief synopsis of your journey. And it was interesting that in the way that you kind of returned to, well, on one hand, a different way of maybe being in the world, but also you mentioned a couple of things that struck me as somewhat political. So I'm sort of curious about those bookends that are both religious and political. How would you say those things are related, at least in your own experience and journey?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a great question. And there's more architecture to the book than you think. I tried to separate reporting, and that's really what the book is. It's reporting from editorial stuff. And the first editorial section is 9/11. The last editorial section is 11/9, and it's the day that Trump was elected. And again, if you believe that everybody's related and everything's connected, there isn't too much that he wanted to do, in my opinion, that was helpful. And so I didn't realize how much it affected me until I went about a year or two without writing anything. And, you know, I was kind of caught up in the politics and everything. And I went back to the draft and said, when's the last time I touched it? And it was 11/9. I had not been able to write since the election. And I have people that tell me, well, you offended me a few times. The tone of the book is so soft that it doesn't offend people. But there are people that said, well, if I were you, this is just friendly advice. I do some different things. You kind of let the Muslims off the hook. I said, I'm okay with that. You kind of presented a balanced view of abortion. That's my issue. I don't think it's balanced at all. I understand. I'm okay with that. I like everything in the book. I understand. I got your message loud and clear. I just don't think you should have brought up Trump. And from my perspective, it's like, well, look, if you like the book and you got the message and you understood everything I said, then Trump has to be in the book. The book does come back to the beginning and sort of said, well, let's look at things a different way. The end of the book talks about long cycles, that there's folks that say, well, there's 80-year periods of, you know, rise and fall. And you can take the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, to World War II to today. Those are 80-year time periods. Mm-hmm. And so we just happen to be kind of in a trough. And I think some of the division that we see, this is notoriously unreliable, but there's folks that look at the world and say, how many people can this earth support? And there's one guy that said, well, we can really support about 3.5 billion people in a middle class living. Well, that's like what we had 80 years ago. But today we have 8 billion people. And so, you know, you think of everybody coming back from World War II and setting up houses and buying homes and getting jobs in corporate America. And they're all thinking the pie is just growing and growing and growing. There's just opportunity as far as I can see. And today I think we're more constrained. We realize that for some people to get more, other people have to get less, you know, and if we're going to improve things like climate, you know, we're going to have to dial back a little bit. And so it's not an overtly political message, but the message I guess I want to get across was, well, you know, Politics counts. Decisions count. We pass laws and we enforce them in accordance to how we think we're supposed to treat people and how we're supposed to treat the earth. So it is important. And then from a spiritual standpoint, I sort of came back and said, well, you know, I'm taken with the Eastern religions. I'm really taken with the mystics. But, you know, Jesus is still a compelling figure to me. Jesus is not Western. Jesus didn't read Aristotle, and he grew up in the Middle East. He was, I'm sure, influenced by people in the East.
Are you sure Jesus wasn't a Platonist? I don't know.
What about if somebody says to me, well, I don't think your book is biblical, or I'm not so concerned if it's biblical. I don't really read the Bible to say, well, I, you know, this tells me exactly what to do. But on the other hand, I don't think the idea that everybody's related and everything's connected is so different from the idea that you're supposed to love your neighbor and your enemy is your neighbor too. I mean, it's just, I'm worried about calling the book The Way, because a lot of people in the West say, well, that sounds very much like you're going to prescribe a very narrow. And I said, no, I'm not at all. And in the foreword, Jim Palmer says, that's not what he's doing. You know, he's identifying a way that is really common. It's the perennial philosophy. You know, it's common to a lot of different traditions.
Well, I think that's interesting, that sort of tension within the way that gets articulated, right? Because you're right. The Way sounds pretty singular. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear from what I was reading that you are advocating for a perennialist view where there's one mountaintop, many paths. So there's not one way necessarily.
Right.
I suppose maybe just rhetorically that works a little bit better than, you know, choose your own adventure.
Yeah. And it's also, it's a significant term in the East. I mean, the Tao is basically the way. Mm-hmm. Zen is my tradition now. It was influenced by Taoism. So they talk about the way.
Yes. Yeah, I think you're right. And I think maybe I'm in a somewhat similar position. I still circulate in church circles and have similar kinds of conversations. I remember not too long ago, and, you know, I teach a Sunday school, and I was talking about the soul, and I'm, you know, not trying to show my hand too much, but I'm just kind of raising questions. And you can tell that, you know, some people are less receptive to those kinds of things than others, and that's fine. So that's one thing that I think is helpful, at least in terms of my own thinking, and it's something I try to advocate for, is thinking about Christianity less as a sort of, yes, it's a tradition. Yes, there are certain propositions that maybe culturally or socially you're asked to adhere to, but I think ultimately, or more primordially, what Christianity calls its followers to, or its adherence to, is a certain way.
Right.
It's a kind of pathfinding, mm-hmm, that Jesus, I suppose, inaugurated. And there's many kinds of like symbolic signposts along this way. I mean, different ways of kind of reading your own experience into the world and so on. So I really do think that idea of pathfinding can be really helpful.
Yeah. You know, one thing I learned early on as I looked at other religions are just not creedal. You know, there's not a Jewish creed or a Muslim creed or a Hindu creed for sure. There's not a Buddhist creed. And so I've talked before, I talk at churches and such, and I talked at a church one time about, you know, belief and community and practice. And Christianity is all about belief. And sadly, when people leave Christianity, and plenty of them do, you say, well, what's your community now? Well, I don't have a community. Well, what's your spiritual practice? Well, I don't have a practice. You know, I junked all that when I decided that I didn't accept the beliefs. And I talk to my friends in church and say, am I welcome at your church? They say, well, do you believe what I believe? No. Are you open to what I believe? I mean, I'm open to anything, but I have my own beliefs and I'm not likely to change them. Well, why would you want to come to my church? And I said, well, why would it matter that you and I believe exactly the same thing to pray or sing or listen to a sermon? You know, I just, the exclusivity is really, it's troubling, you know, it's really troubling.
Yeah.
Now, one thing that I have navigated, I vacation a place in Colorado. It's at 8,000 feet, and they have a bunch of spiritual centers there, so people can, you know, actually chant the Shiva and whirl with dervishes and stuff. And a guy came out, a really good friend, very fundamental, and he said, "Tell me about your book." And I started to tell him. He said, Don't even go there. The earth was created 6,000 years ago. Everyone but Noah's family is wiped out in a great flood. All the dinosaurs died too. And I said, well, shoot, Tom, we're 8,000 feet. Did the water really get to 8,000 feet above sea level all over the world? Where did all that water come from? Where did all that water go? How did all those kangaroos get all the way from Australia to the Middle East, get on an ark, and then swim all the way back to Australia? How come we don't find dinosaur bones and human bones in the same places? And I said, but you might be right. And I said, I wasn't here 6,000 years ago. I wasn't here 13 billion years ago. Don't know if there was a great flood. Don't know if there's a big bang. Got my own opinion, just told you about it, but I don't know. And, you know, and then it was interesting. I said to him, now it's your turn. What do you mean? I said, just say to me, you might be right. I can't do it. And I said, well, listen, I love you. I'm not upset. I'm not angry. But that's kind of arrogant and dismissive to me after I just said, you might be right. He said, yeah, I hear you. So a few days later, we're out in the backyard. We're looking at the mountains. We're smoking cigars and drinking scotch. And hey, he said, you know that conversation we had the other day? I said, yeah. He said, you might be right. And to me, it's not really a big concession to tell somebody you might be right. More people need to do it. I mean, if there's a lesson in the book, just recognize that all religion's cultural, all theology is speculation. You don't know any more, any less than anybody else. And you might be right and you might be wrong. And same for the other guy. And it's kind of my catchphrase, I guess, you know, that I tell that story and it resonates with people because there's so few people in the world that can say you might be. And, you know, when he said that, like I say, it wasn't a huge concession. He didn't.
It might have been a huge concession for him.
Well, no, I know it might have been, but I'm just saying it's not like anybody won or anybody lost. We just met right here where I said, you might be right. And he said, you might be right. And there was just parity. You know, there was understanding. There was a willingness to say, well, we disagree, but we can do that. It's okay.
Yeah. I think it's okay. I think people are willing to kind of share in that ambiguity if there are shared values. Mm-hmm. I think from my experience, if there are not shared values, then it becomes a little bit more difficult. I thought one of the things that you said was really interesting, how when you began this journey, you assumed that you would just validate what you were already told. I think it's very unusual in terms of a quote unquote, what you might characterize as someone's, you know, deconstruction story. I'm not applying that label to you.
No, but it didn't start out that way. That's the point.
No, and I think that's really interesting to think about, right? This journey began from a place of sincerity. And yeah. I think that's oftentimes what's lost on those who are quote unquote left behind.
Yeah.
These people are deconstructing themselves right out of the building.
Well, you know, to that point, I got thrown out of the building.
Well, that'll happen.
When I was a Roman Catholic, my wife was not, but she went to Mass with me every week for 30 years. Right. It was a don't ask, don't tell that she received communion, even though technically she's not supposed to.
Right.
So one day we're at an out-of-town wedding and somebody says, hey, if you're not Catholic, you're not welcome at communion. She sort of says, well, I'm out. I'm done. And I had to say, well, I'm done too. I mean, Jesus eats with Judas, but the Catholic Church doesn't eat with my wife. I mean, what is that? And this was during all the investigation I was doing and the questions I was having, and it was kind of a last straw. And then I got thrown out of a Protestant church, and I really was more thrown out. I was in the Disciples of Christ, which was and is a very, you know, open and inclusive denomination, no creed but Christ, all are welcome, open communion. A lot of the people get there come from Catholicism, they're Lutherans, they're Baptists, they're Methodists, whatever, and they bring all that with them. So we had a Bible study, and the pastor asked an innocent question, and I offered an innocent answer, and the next guy piped up and said, well, I have a different answer than Larry, but, you know, Larry's not really a Christian. I said, you know, I let it go in the meeting, and I talked to him afterwards, and I said, that There was really no place for that. I mean, I don't know if I'm a Christian or not. You're certainly not the judge of whether I'm a Christian. And it's not when they ask you a question, you're not supposed to answer for me or about me. And it was kind of a culmination of some other things. And I just said, look, I love you. There's no hard feelings. We'll part as friends, but I can't come back here. And his comment was, well, I understand you have to leave, but please don't leave now because it'll look like I did it. And I said, well, you did kind of do it. You know, I mean, he was really concerned about how it appeared to him not to move. So.
Right.
But that's just like, you know, I just was trying to give you the idea that there wasn't really a point in time when I said, I've had enough of this until I was really provoked, until I was just practically pushed out the door. And a lot of people say, well, no, I didn't leave the church left me. And I feel a little bit bad.
Yeah. You know, the question of identity is, it sounds like for you is less important than perhaps it once was, but just out of curiosity, are you happy to sort of put your hand up? If I was to say, hey, you know, where are all my Christians at? Are you going to put your hand up? Do you have a problem identifying that way?
Well, I'll tell you this. What I tell people is I'm a follower of Jesus with a Zen practice. And I mean, you know, Jesus was formative for most people in our culture.
Whether they knew it or not.
Yeah. And I don't really find much fault in what Jesus did. And Jesus didn't kick me out of any of those churches. But, you know, I'm at this point somebody that says, well, I don't really believe in talking snakes or global floods or virgin births or physical resurrections. I don't believe in personal gods or trinities. I don't believe God writes books. I don't believe he sets laws. I don't believe I have a soul or that I'm going to be judged or sent to heaven or hell. So if Christianity were accepting enough to say, well, come on in, none of that's a problem with us. But it is a problem. So
yeah.
So I would say, no, I'm not a Christian at this point. Now, I'll say this. I have a very eclectic spiritual practice. And so, you know, when I go to Colorado, like I say, I'll go visit the ashram. I'll visit the Sufi center. I'll get a shumei healing. I come home. I have a Zen practice. I'm actually a member of a Zen community. I have a Zen teacher. I speak at the Unitarian Universalist Church. Uh-huh. I'm in a discussion group there. I'm in a book club at Unity. I've occasionally done Bible study at the Methodist Church. I'm on the phone once a week with a bunch of progressive Christians that live in another community. And so at the end of the year, when it's time to do my giving, I guess the IRS is going to audit me and wonder what kind of scam this is, because there's money going to the Buddhists and the Hindus and the Catholics and everybody. I go to Mass when I go to Colorado. So. And I'm comfortable there because I'm comfortable in places that will accept me. And none of those places I mentioned have ever said to me, well, what do you actually believe? Are you one of us or one of them? If you don't believe what we believe, will you believe what we believe? None of them. And so, yeah. You know, again, that's a problem that Christianity has. It's pretty unique. Not everybody is going to give you a theological litmus test at the door. I Googled one time what we believe, and I got thousands and thousands of answers, all churches, and it was all Christian churches. I thought there'd be economics clubs and political parties and everything. No, no. What we believe is all about church.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I was just talking about this earlier today with Justin. You know, I work in kind of a corporate space for an environmental company. And I've been asked to put together a white paper on our sustainability efforts over the last year. Sure. And my supervisor is reviewing it and he's like, oh, you know what we need in this? He's like, all this is good. This is fine. But we need to be a little bit stronger on our convictions. I said, oh, convictions. Okay. Yeah. And so of course, like my religious ears are kind of perking up at that. And then I'm like, well, what do you mean? He's like, well, you know, we need to put forward in strong terms, you know, we believe X, we believe Y, we believe Z. And I'm like, I said to him, I was like, I got to tell you, this sounds like a religion. And I'm not sure that's the vibe you want to give off. Yeah, I suppose I just mentioned that because I don't think that's unique to Christianity, or I guess maybe what I'm going to say is that culturally, this is something that we've inherited from Christianity. We circumscribe identity in association or indexed with, you know, these different kinds of statements about belief and so on. I just think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I say that in the book. It's cool that you brought that up. You know, I ask in the book, well, when I'm talking about politics, well, where did we learn that, you know, we could only associate with people that believe what we believe? Well, we learned that in church. Where did we learn that people believe what we believe are good and other people are bad? Well, we learned that in church. One thing that we haven't talked about is, you know, that when you talk about politics and religion, there's a politics of personal responsibility and there's a theology of personal salvation. And the idea of a person runs through and through both Western culture and Western religion. And so, you know, if you're to contrast, we say, well, in the West, you know, we believe God is a person. He's three persons. The second person actually incarnated, we can have a personal relationship with that person, and then he'll ensure our personal salvation. And in the East, where these things are not quite as ingrained, somebody says, well, what if there's no such thing as a person? What if a personhood is a construct? You know, as Thomas Merton said, we live lives of self-impersonation. You know, we live up to our own expectations and other people's expectations. And in the East, they say, who are you? And I say, well, I'm a guy that wrote a book. Well, you weren't always that. Well, I'm a grandfather, father, husband. Well, you weren't always that. Well, I have an okay sense of humor. Well, you weren't always that. In other words, you just keep peeling the onion. And in the East, there's nothing there. There's just like, you know, you've constructed this identity, but there's no there. And that doesn't go down too well in the West. In the West, we want to think, no, by golly, I am a person. By golly, I have a soul. I go to breakfast with a bunch of guys. They're not really spiritual at all. They were casually interested in the book just because I wrote it. And a couple of them read it and said, yeah, it was pretty good. And a lot of them said, I agreed with most everything you said in there. And I said, do you think you have a soul? Oh, yes. You know, and maybe 70% of the people in the West think that they have a soul.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I have a soul or not, but I don't have any evidence that I have a soul. I couldn't tell you what it did or where it is or how it transports part of me to someplace else and what part of it goes with it and what part of it stays. But again, yeah. The people in the pews, that's upsetting. It's an upsetting notion.
Yeah. Well, when you've kind of received this kind of Aristotelian view of the soul combined with a vision of the hereafter, and you've never heard any sort of alternatives to that, I understand how that's, you know, very maybe disorienting in the best case and upsetting.
Yeah.
in most cases.
Yeah. No question.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's part of that is a function of just the way that language works. Like I'm happy to use language of the soul. I think it kind of speaks to a certain dimension of human existence and experience that, you know, maybe doesn't translate into other kind of language. Yeah. But I mean, to say that I have a soul, I mean, I don't know what that means exactly. Like where is my soul? Exactly. Yes. Is it in my pineal gland? Is it in my ball sack? Sorry, right. I don't mean to be a.
but that's the question. Yeah. But if somebody said, you know, if I say, well, that affected me, you know, that was good for my soul. That's a way to use a term that people understand. I wouldn't argue with it. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. I sort of use soul language as shorthand for the totality of my being. I don't know if that works for anyone else, but there was one thing in here that I thought was really interesting where you're talking about the mystics and scientists, and you draw kind of an interesting connection between them. You write this: what do the mystics say about God? What do the scientists say about the universe? Both seek truth through experience. I think that's really interesting, the kind of foregrounding of a kind of empiricism between the mystics and the scientists. And I think for most people, those two things are on completely opposite sides of the fence.
Yeah. Well, a mystic has a much more qualitative experience, but But yeah, I think I wanted to say what I said, that they're both seeking experience. The other thing later in the book, I was worried that the book would be accessible enough because it talks about a lot of things that could have been difficult. And in the quantum physics section, I kind of make points about quantum physics by tying it back to the Hindu way of thinking about things. And I was trying to make the connection that, you know, if you've read the Tao of Physics, it's an old book, but he makes a very explicit tie between the Eastern mystics and the quantum physicists. And, you know, when you talk about things like non-locality and the field, you know, the mystics, there are some people who say, oh, well, I had a vision of the Virgin Mary. What religion are you? Well, I'm Catholic. How did you know? You know, well, because Catholics see the Virgin Mary. Nobody, not too many other people see the Virgin Mary. But most people, what almost everybody from every tradition does, there's a textbook mystical experience where somebody says, gosh, all of a sudden I was in the same place, but it was different.
Yeah.
And, you know, instead of seeing my hand, I just saw like every particle, every drop of dew, every blade of grass. I felt this sense of benevolence. I felt like every question was answered. And something like 30% of the people have had that experience. And to me, it's like, well, wait a second. It was striking to me because I was conditioned to think, well, you know, you'll meet a person or three people probably, and then you'll see all the popes lined up, and then here's grandma, and, you know, oh, I'm in heaven. I made it. I didn't go to the other place. Maybe even have a vision of passing through a judgment. None of that happens. The what you get in a mystical experience is much more like the field, the non-local sense, the connection, the benevolent presence. I'll say this, like if I would have discovered, well, everybody that has a mystical experience, they encounter Jesus, no matter what religion. Well, that would have been really compelling to me. Or if they said, well, everybody encounters Krishna, no matter what religion, that would have been pretty compelling to me. But instead, it was a very impersonal encounter. Now, I don't mean impersonal like it didn't affect somebody to their core. I just mean, again, it wasn't a person. And in the West, we're so hung up on personhood that I think there's probably, well, I know there are. My wife has had an experience like that. And, you know, I read all these books. I'm very analytical. And so every once in a while, I'll slam a book shut and I'll say, man, you're not going to believe what I just read. And so one day I said, you're not going to believe what I just read. I was telling her about the mystics. Like, tear starts coming down. She says, I've had that experience. I never told you. I didn't know what it was. And oh, see, wow. I think if she would have met Jesus or met Krishna, she would have known it was a religious or spiritual experience. But when you just have this sense of benevolence and a sense of connectedness and you're stitched into the fabric of the universe, that's not what people expect. But I think that's what's out there. You know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the reasons I like Clayton Crockett's book, you know, he asks questions like, well, is God consciousness? Is God energy? You know, we have these big things. We think consciousness is everywhere. Energy is everywhere. You know, maybe God is everywhere. And we can't really explain it. And then if I told you, well, no, there are three different things. Let's distinguish between God and consciousness and energy. Well, you couldn't really do that. Just like when somebody says to me, where did you kind of run up against something? I said, well, all kinds of places. I mean, I think the universe is eternal. I'm not sure that it was created. Again, it would have been compelling to me if the scientist said, hey, the only way this could have happened is somebody made it happen. But that's not what they say. But I'm stuck there. I don't know how the universe was created. I don't know how life began. I don't think it was supernatural, but it might have been. I don't know where consciousness came from. I'm kind of inclined to think it's embedded in everyone and everything, but I don't know that. But, you know, people say, well, what puzzles you now? Well, there's things that we don't understand. And I'm hesitant to say, well, that's supernatural, because people used to hear lightning and hear thunder and see lightning and say, well, that's supernatural. Mm-hmm. So anything we don't understand, it might be something that we understand someday or not. So I'm agnostic about that too. Yeah. But if somebody says to me, well, tell me about remote sensing, tell me about past life recollections, tell me about near-death experiences, those are all things that we don't understand. Personally, I sort of feel like I kind of like consciousness and energy and God. I just rather lump them all together and say these are all things of a kind that we don't understand. It would make sense to me if there was mind beyond brain, if we all had access to information, not necessarily my past life or your past life, just collective past life, and whether it's a hallucinogenic drug or a seizure or a, you know, or a near-death experience or prayer or what have you, somebody's filters drop and they see that every blade of grass, every drop of dew, they access mind beyond brain. I don't know if that's the answer, but you know, if that's not the answer, then it's something equally as speculative, as mysterious. You know, if it's not the same thing that's affecting all those different experiences, well, then I have to come up with four or five different answers. How does a near-death experience happen? How does a past life recollection happen? I don't know. I hope it's one answer.
Yeah, you know, there was a time not that long ago when if the conversation turned to past life experiences or telepathy or these kinds of things, I would roll my eyes and I would say, oh, that's nice. Sure. And I guess the subtle shift for me has been, to your point, a sort of onboarding and acceptance of the idea that the universe is far more complex, ineffable, and inexplicable than I have the capacity to understand. And to make a very strange and vulgar metaphor, a five-year-old does not know that blue cheese is good. No. That was probably the worst example, but it's where my mind went.
But I think it's well said. I think that that you just do sort of have to acknowledge the mystery. And to me, I'm always very careful to tell people, look, just because I say I don't believe in a personal God, I don't believe that God writes books, that I go to heaven, that I have a soul, I don't know what to believe about things that could be supernatural. I have a tremendous amount of awe. I have gratitude. I have reverence. I have a sense of responsibility. I feel like I've had 66 years so far. I hope I get 86. You know, some guys get 106. I might not be here next week. But the fact that I don't think this is some kind of training ground, you know, for an eternal future, I think this is the real deal. This is as good as it gets. And like I say, I have so much more awe and gratitude and reverence and responsibility. Because, as you said, the universe is just so ineffable, so overwhelming.
What you're saying resonates with me. It comports, I suppose, with what little I know about the spiritual experience / journey. I still tend to think about these kinds of things through the symbolic structure that I've inherited, which is Christianity.
Yeah.
Something I often return to is the fruit of the spirit, which I think is the litmus test. It's not, do you co-sign on, you know, X, Y, and Z propositions? Are you willing to kind of go along with the Nicene, blah, blah, blah? I don't think ultimately any of that shit matters. I think what ultimately matters is how you show up for people, how you're caring for people.
Of course.
The kind of energy. I mean, I sound like a fucking hippie. I know
I'm
I do.
With you. I'm with you.
But the kind of energy you give off, like, are you an encouraging person? These kinds of things. And, you know, there's a cynical part of me that while I'm saying that kind of thing is self-critical, I'm also aware that that's not the only way to be in the world. And that's not the only valid way to be in the world. And that there are people who, for the purposes of whatever, liberation, broadly speaking, we need folks who are pissed off and are going to take up arms. And that sort of thing. And it's not as simple as we often make it out to be. The world is far more complex than we can possibly know. Yeah, I think that's something I'd want to hold to.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the idea you might be right. It's not just glib. I mean, there's a real humility that comes to wrestling with all these questions and realizing, well, I mean, nobody knows and nobody maybe ever will know. And there's lots of paths up the mountain, and there are people that read the book. And at the end of the book, I say, you know what, if you get it, that, and you can use your own language, you can say, love your neighbor, or you can say everybody's related. It's the same to me. as long as you get that, you're good. You're good. And there's people who read the book and say, wow, that was that was interesting. I hadn't thought about some of that stuff. I don't agree with you about much of it, but I'm a better Christian now that I've read your book. And that's,
yeah, it's nice.
It's nice, yeah.
I think there's a certain acceptable degree of ambiguity within a lot of Christian circles where it's like, oh, yeah, you know, a lot of these kinds of theological questions are up for debate, but what are our non-negotiables? You know, like I hear this a lot. And so they're kind of circling back to this propositional form. And and I think they're wrong in kind of making that move, but I actually like the question of what are my non-negotiables, you know, because some of the things that we've been saying can sound like, oh, you know, there's too much of an ambivalence, a moral ambivalence. But like, there are moments, at least from my own experience, where I'm like, this is not negotiable. Like, you can't put kids in cages and say that's okay.
Yes.
We're not going to have a conversation about it.
Right.
Does that resonate at all with you? Are there?
I said that. I said, you know, you don't take away people's health care. You don't separate families. You don't build walls. You don't ban Muslims. But none of those things have to be commandments. The commandment is either really take seriously, love your neighbor as yourself, or just recognize everybody's related, everybody's connected. So that stuff's off limits. You know, if you wouldn't do it to yourself, if you wouldn't do it to your brother, then don't do it to somebody else.
Yeah.
On doctrinal stuff, I had an interesting conversation when I was at the Disciples. The Disciples of Christ comes out of the Stone-Campbell movement, and either Stone or Campbell was a Unitarian. He was not a Trinitarian. So somebody said, well, what is it that's fundamental to our beliefs? Maybe it's that God is three persons. And I said, well, one of the disciples was not a Trinitarian. He was a Unitarian, meaning Stone or Campbell.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. The apostles were all heretics.
Well, yeah. Well,
by your definition.
Well, here's the other thing, though. She said, no, I mean, which of the 12? Well, none of the 12 were Trinitarian.
Right.
Trinity, you know, came along 200 or 300 years later. So when somebody says to me, I just want to go back to the original Christianity. Okay, let's go. James, Jesus' brother, is running the show. It ain't Peter, it ain't Paul. He does it for 30 years out of Jerusalem. He worships in a temple. You know, as recently as 50 years after Jesus' death, the Didache mentions Jesus only one place where in a hymn to God, they say, you're noble servant Jesus. So Jesus was not conceived among the early Jewish Christians as God. There was no Bible. There was no clergy. There was no church building. There was no doctrine. So if somebody says, I want to go back to first century Christianity, doesn't look much like 21st century Christianity.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the problem with this sort of primitivist position. You know, let's get back to our roots. I'm like, yeah, is that really what you want? This book is, and this is not a criticism at all, just more of a sort of observation that I think you maybe touch on this. This is really a broad, I don't know, religious survey rather than a sort of deep dive on any particular topic. That being said, you touch on a lot of topics in this book.
Yeah.
If you just look at the table of contents, it seems very ambitious, right? But then each of the sections is, you know, a page or two. Tell me about the decision to organize the book in this way.
Yeah.
What was the thought process behind going that very broad route rather than a very sort of narrowing in on a specific topic or something like that?
Well, because nobody reads anymore. And so nobody's going to go read the 1,000 books I read. Nobody's interested enough in patristic Christology in the 300s to go read that book or three books on that. And I felt like, again, I'm a banker. I'm transactional. I'm practical. I was somebody who was saying, I learned a whole lot in this journey. I want to boil it down for my kids, my grandkids, my friends, other people to say, hey, you don't have to sit in a sweat lodge. You don't have to read all these books. part of what the book is trying to do is to say, look, let loose just a little bit. You know, you have these really strong opinions about all these things. And when you really look at how the sausage got made, it's not a very elegant process. Now, there is it at the hinge of the book between the first section and the second. It talks about the dark night of the soul. It talks about the fact that, gosh, I just burned my house down. And it also, and this is unconventional too, there's a section in there that's questions and answers, you know, that somebody that's gotten through part of the book. Well, why should I believe you? Well, how come I wasn't told this? Because those are all questions that I knew that people would have. I was a little afraid because, again, I'm a banker. I'm not a pastor. I'm not a philosopher, a theologian. I was a little bit afraid that the book would not be taken seriously. But in fact, it has been. And people will tell me often, I was fact checking you for the first 20 pages. And then I saw that I didn't have to anymore. Yeah. And I've had people say, well, I spent a few years in divinity school and I didn't know some of this, but I believe it, or I suspected it. And there's been people who say, why doesn't my pastor tell me this? And well, he might have gone to a very conservative seminary where there wasn't a lot of poking around at some of this stuff, or he could have come out of seminary with a whole bunch of questions that he really didn't feel like his bosses, the Catholic bishops or the Methodist hierarchy or what have you, his bosses don't want you going to church and saying, you know, you might not have a soul after all. That would be distressing to people. And even if your bosses said go, there's no sense in misleading people. Just tell them that, you know, some of this stuff, that it's not set in stone.
Yeah.
The people don't want to hear it. You don't want to go to church and get alarmed that you might not see grandma when you die. I mean, it's a big deal.
It's kind of silly in a certain sense when you put it that way, or it seems kind of trite, but I think that's,
it's not,
you know, it's not for a lot of people. They really want to see their grandma. For me personally, I could do without seeing my grandma. So maybe that's why I kind of take a different approach. But one thing that I appreciate about the ethos, I think, that funds a book like this is a willingness to ask any question and see where it goes. I mean, that's something that I very much appreciate and resonate with. So I just want to kind of say that.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. It took me to places I didn't expect to go to.
Mm-hmm. So in your sort of, I don't know, your theological journey, your spiritual journey, what was the biggest shock to the system? Was there any moment where you were just like, oh my God, I don't know how to deal with this, or, you know, I don't know if I can continue, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, I went through a lot of read a book, put it down, read another book, And then I did get to a point of thinking, well, wait a second. I just said to this, but I just read a book that I said to something else. So I don't know the answer, but either the universe was created or it wasn't, but it's not both, you know, or God is personal or he's not. It's not both. God has intention or not. It's not both. Consciousness is fundamental or not. It's not both. So you have to read a bunch to sort of connect everything up and then realize, oh my gosh, there's a missing piece here. This thing doesn't jihad with that thing. And so that was a realization. And then there were plenty of times where I would just bump into something, for instance, consciousness. And we don't talk about that. Philosophers do, but the guy in the pew doesn't talk about consciousness. In the East, everybody talks about consciousness. And it took me a year to write that chapter just because I just had to sort of get smart on it, as smart as I could. And then there was one other eye-opener, and that was free will. And to me, two eye-openers, personhood and free will, but they're linked. Free will, you know, and there's people that will tell you, well, a lot of what you do, it's because of your chemistry or it's because of your conditioning. It's not necessarily predetermined. There's randomness, just like there is in quantum physics, but there's a lot of chance. You don't really think your thoughts, they arrive. And if we hook up your brain and said, when did you decide to reach for your cup of coffee? It might be 10 seconds after you reached for the cup of coffee. So your brain might be reporting, not directing.
Yeah, or before, I think, which is like the little bit more, for me, the disorienting, right? Like somehow a part of me has already decided to do this thing, right?
Right. And so that's very disarming, because it's hard to imagine that there would be a punishment or reward if there's not free will. And it's very difficult to say there's not free will. So it's one of those questions like a soul, where you say, I don't think I have free will. And I don't say it absolutely. I say I certainly don't have as much as I used to think I have.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It certainly appears that I do have free will. But let's say I don't have any free will. And I'm at St. Peter's Gate. And he says, I don't know, Larry, you kind of screwed up on some stuff here. Not me. You know, so everybody goes through. And, you know, if everybody passes the test, why do you have a test? And why do you even make rules if I can't control whether I'm going to follow them? And let's say somebody says, oh, you've really overstayed the case. You are responsible for at least half of the things that you do because of your own free will. Well, how does that work? I'm at Peter's Gate, and he says, you're going to spend half an eternity in here. And then where do I go? You know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're touching on the question of rewards and punishments. And I don't know if I want to necessarily get into all of that, but I mean, I certainly sympathize with the direction of your questioning. But you were invoking a number of dualisms just before, right? It can't be both this and that.
Yeah, and I realize that God can be essentially impersonal, but can manifest as a person.
Yeah, I think the ontological question of all those things can be readily displaced in favor of, you know, a more phenomenological approach, or even a sort of just a more contingent approach. Well, it's like, well, it's true from this perspective, and you know, there's a perspectivalism, I think, that comes into play there too. Do you worry about violating the law of non-contradiction?
No, because there's so much that I'm just willing to admit I don't understand and don't understand. I hold my convictions pretty loosely as a result of all this. I mean, the conviction I hold very dear is just to love your neighbor, everybody's related. But past that, I'd love to see grandma again, you know? I mean, there's a lot of comforting things about beliefs that I don't necessarily subscribe to. Somebody says, oh, Larry, you got it all wrong. There's a loving God. Wonderful. No, there's rules, and, you know, you seem to be following along pretty well, and you're going to be rewarded, and you're going to see grandma, and you do have free will, and God's not going to violate your free will. Well, that's good news. I'd love to hear it. But, you know, from the Zen practice, there's not doctrine in Zen. And when you talk to your Zen teacher, you don't talk about the Buddha, or, well, you talk a little bit about the Buddha, but there's not doctrine in Zen. It's like, how is your practice? Are you realizing your interconnectedness? And, you know, when you ask the Buddha, is there a God? Is there a meaning to life? Where do I go when I die? He's like, well, that's all speculative. You know, it's
right.
It's all speculative. So no, I don't worry about my ideas bumping into each other because I've thrown my hands up a few times, I guess.
Yeah, fair. So recently I've been in a conversation with Trip Fuller from the Holy Humanity podcast, and you mentioned you listened to that. They're doing this whole project, God After Deconstruction, where they're trying to reach a sort of a broader, not just an expangelical audience, but, you know, this broader movement where people are kind of distancing themselves from inherited beliefs and traditions and so on. And I think a lot of them they all have their sort of their own trajectory and story. I think yours is an interesting one as well. I'm just saying that's because I'd love to put you in touch with him, and, you know, maybe you guys can have a conversation and something will come of that.
Yeah, that'd be great. I thought the discussion you had with Ord was terrific. He's a very courageous guy. You were able to discuss things with him that it was clear that, you know, you didn't necessarily agree on everything that was said, but there was a lot of respect and trust, and it was like a master course on how to have that kind of conversation. And I've seen him a few times, and he's always very good. But I don't agree with him on things either. My deconstruction, I think, as I told you earlier, was It's pretty radical, and I understand that. And it's kind of shocking when you think 60 years ago, I was in Latin Mass, 50 years ago, I was in altar boy. I've come a long way. Some people would say that that's progress, and some people might say not, but it's
you backsliding motherfucker.
right. But I've come a long way. And just to say one thing about the book has been such a blessing to me. It's kind of introduced me to people like you. I get emails from people. I like the book. I enjoyed your story. Here's my story. There's people all over the world that have bought the book. It's given me a platform that I never had. It's let me talk about things that I spent a long time thinking about. It's just such a joy to sit down and have these conversations. Because so much of it was just, I sat at my desk for 6 years and nobody saw the book. I tell my wife I'm not ready yet. And it was just so lonely. And I was just so afraid that I was going to get hit by a car. I'd be in the ambulance. He says, you're not going to make it. I said, I have to make it. I have a book. And my wife and I had a deal. At some point, she said, I'll be able to finish the book if you can. And so there was a day when she said, and she hates it when I tell this story, but you can die now. I can finish the book for you. But it was really, I tell people, it was like coughing up a hairball. It was something that, and a lot of it was, I just felt like it was such an interesting journey. And I thought, well, what are you supposed to do? You're not just supposed to keep that all to yourself. I mean, it was such a, there was so many interesting questions, so many places it brought me. When you say, well, I want to learn about religion, you end up learning about history, philosophy, theology, psychology, chemistry, biology. I mean, it was just and I had a very utilitarian education where I didn't have a philosophy-oriented track at all. And early on, people said, well, do you know anything about philosophy? I said, no, I really don't want to. I'm a banker. I don't need to know anything about philosophy. But when you ask these big questions, that's where you end up,
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, but you dig deep enough, eventually you'll end up in I don't know, a certain kind of monism. That's not exactly how I want to say it, but a realization that similar to maybe the one that you've come to, that everything is connected in important ways.
Einstein said, I believe in the God that Spinoza believes in. That's kind of my God too.
Well, I'm always happy to end giving Spinoza the last word. I feel like there was a couple other things I wanted to ask you about, but they're kind of escaping me now. Where can people find the book, get in touch with you, et cetera?
Sure. Okay. I'm supposed to be easy to find. The book is called The Way, Meaningful Spirituality for a Modern World. It's on Amazon. If you ask your library, your bookstore, they probably don't have it, but they could get it. I have a website, LarryJordanAuthor.com, and I blog at Patheos, and the name of the column is You Might Be Right. And it's really, I've only put up 3 or 4 of them, but eventually it's gonna touch on a lot of the things we've talked about. And it's supposed to sort of fill a hole for somebody looking across different traditions and looking at things from an inner spiritual way. I ran into things like, I'm having a lunch with a good friend of mine who's a pastor, and tell him about Buddhism. And I said, there's a concept in Buddhism of void, and it's such a strange word. I don't expect to hear it. And he says, well, it's not a strange word. It comes right out of Genesis. Void is what was there before creation was there. And it's sort of an analogous concept in Buddhism. So there's things that sort of resonated with me as I was doing this that I just thought, wow, I guess I really didn't realize that you were talking about symbols. I didn't realize the symbolism that's really cross-culturally,
Yeah. One of the things that I'm hearing you say and that I'm glad to hear is that it seems like you've maybe found your own voice, your own sort of theological voice. And that's something that I guess I just want to say, nice job. Congratulations, because that's not easy to do, especially if you're someone like me who deals with issues of shame and does my voice count sort of thing? Do I have anything to say?
Right.
I'm kind of, maybe I'm projecting a little bit too much here.
Oh, no, you're right on. You're dead on. Yeah.
But I think that's fantastic. And I'm glad there's a lot of like generative conversations that are kind of coming out of that. So yeah, it was great to talk to you. I'll link to the book and to your blog and so on. And let's stay in touch.
Well, listen, I thank you. I really have enjoyed it. It was great. I've listened to you so much. It was nice to finally talk to you. So
now you can see how the sausage is made. It's not, it's not so pretty.
No, you're doing good work, and I appreciate it.
All right, Larry. Take care, man.
Hey, thanks. You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.